This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 22nd of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, I'll be discussing the day's top news stories with Shashank Joshi and Jeffrey Kaufman. High up in the Swiss Alps, France's Prime Minister has been issuing dark warnings about the future of Europe in the face of a wave of refugees and migrants arriving on the continent's shores. But are his comments helpful? We'll have that debate. We'll also look to the source of the refugee crisis, the war in Syria, and ask whether upcoming peace talks can change the situation on the ground. And later in the programme, America's most respected conservative magazine has declared war on Donald Trump. Will this be the straw that breaks Trump's back? All that plus Egypt 5 years after the Arab Spring and the latest developments on the assassination of Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko. That's all on Midori House, starting right now with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Jeffrey Kaufman, a veteran foreign correspondent. And of course, both Jeffrey and Shashank are regular Monocle 24 contributors. Welcome to you both. We'll begin today with the chatter coming from up high in the Alps in Davos. During an interview at the World Economic Forum, the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, has warned that European society will be totally destabilised if action isn't taken regarding the huge influx of refugees and asylum seekers. Shashank Joshi, is he right or is this slightly overblown?
I think he is right. In the first 3 weeks of this year, they've had about 35,000 despite adverse weather conditions. There is a crisis in public confidence, entirely separate to any objective trends following on from the events in Köln and so on. And I think that there's real concern over the institutions of the European Union, things that people may not understand or care about or engage with, but things like the Dublin Agreement on where people have to claim asylum, things like Schengen, the fundamentals of the EU. I think if you're seeing this much concern across the entirety of EU, Dutch, British, German, French leaders, all of them seriously concerned, I think it's not something we can dismiss as crying wolf.
And yet, Jeffrey Kaufman, it's one thing to say, well, look, there's a crisis in public confidence. It's another thing to say that some of the European institutions or the instruments of the European institutions are in trouble. But when you look at the pure numbers, it's like, Jordan can't cope because they've got millions. Lebanon can't cope because they've got millions. France can't cope, really?
This is a huge ethical and moral dilemma for all of us, really. On one hand, as fellow human beings on this planet, we want to reach out to refugees who are enduring, the destruction of their homeland, really, in Syria and parts of Afghanistan and Iraq. On a humane level, it is absolutely logical that we say we want to help you, our fellow man, our fellow woman, and embrace you and give you opportunity. And that's a completely noble instinct. The problem is, and I think Valls really alluded to this today, and I think it's hard to argue against what he said, is that when you say we are going to help you, you are welcome, word gets back to the refugee camps in Jordan and Libya, where we have, 3-4 million people. And the word is, well, if you make it there, they'll let you in. And of course, that is why we're seeing, all of us wise pundits thought that with the cold winter on the Mediterranean, there would be an end, at least seasonally, to the migration. But as has already been noted, it's continuing. People are braving the cold winter Mediterranean seas because they are so desperate and because they believe if they make it to Europe's shores, they can create a new life in Europe. So, there is the other extreme, Australia, which has had this brutal no refugees, no asylum policy, this internment camp in Papua New Guinea that really is a horrific and chilling thing. And yet it has been effective in lowering the in diminishing the attempts to enter Australia illegally. How do you reconcile these two things? But I do agree, something, the message has got to get out that Europe can't handle it. But the bottom line is here, until you give these people a safe place to live, a way to go home, i.e. stabilize Syria, stabilize Afghanistan, this isn't going away.
Steve, I think it's also worth engaging with your point that, look, the burden on us is far less than the burden on local states. We all know the statistics now that, you know, the Za'atari camp in Jordan is one of the biggest cities in the country. The Lebanese population is an enormous proportion of the population. But I think there is still a difference between Arabic-speaking Syrians familiar with the local environment, close to their homes, in proximity in northern Jordan, as opposed to those same people turning up in Stockholm or Paris or Munich or somewhere else. I think that the cultural dislocation is undeniably greater. That's not to say the moral imperative vanishes, but the burden on adjustment and coping with it and doing it gradually, which is not an option we seem to have, is much bigger than it is for doing so in, say, you know, the Bekaa Valley.
And part of the problem, I suppose, as well, Geoffrey, is that Europe isn't really set up to cope with this at the moment in terms of literally how it copes, in terms of the institutions and when people arrive, where they go, where they're then housed, how they're helped to learn languages, find jobs, that sort of thing.
You can actually back up. It even goes earlier than that. Europe doesn't really have a strong border, and that's what we're seeing. It's porous, and the Europe... when the Europe vision was created, they didn't really think that they'd have to put up, you know, an American-style wall as in on the Mexican border, as some people want, and then a fence that already exists. But if that doesn't happen, uncomfortable as it is, the open borders of Schengen, 20-something countries, 24 countries,
26 countries,
26
yeah.
countries will be jeopardized, because countries are going to say, listen, you know, this just isn't, if they make it across into Greece, then they can make their way up to wherever. And that's just not acceptable. But how do you help Greece? You know, you can't say, as I think it was the Prime Minister of Holland or Denmark said this week, you know, they should seek asylum in the first country they landed.
Yeah, Greece, that's Dublin,
right?
That's always been, frankly,
idea. But Greece, if 10 million people, a bankrupt economy, and I think the second largest coastline in the world. I mean, it's just not reasonable to say, Greece, this is your problem.
But the problem, with the Dublin point is that if you are Denmark, say, no one is going to get to your borders without crossing through another EU border anyway.
There are Vikings, Steve. Don't be petty. No, I think that's absolutely right. I think this brings me to a bigger point, which is this is not just about refugees and a narrow issue of settlement. This cuts to the heart of Europe's security as a whole, because when I look at NATO, I see a big division running through it. The Eastern countries, obviously the Baltics, but also Poland, Romania, Hungary, are terrified by Russia. They want troops. They want forward defences. They want to abrogate agreements not to put troops in. The southern countries like Italy, Portugal, Spain, Greece say, well, good for you, but actually, when we asked you to distribute refugees equally, what was that you told us? Oh, yes, well, we refer you to the same answer now. And so this policy is not in isolation or quarantined. It's about a bigger division between Europe's east and its south. And I worry about the future of NATO as well as a result.
And on that same line as well, Germany has been making it quite clear that the rest of Europe was quite happy to call on Germany's help when it came to bailing out southern nations, helping out with saving the euro. But now Jeffrey Kaufmann, when they turn around and say, OK, guys, you're going to help out with taking a few refugees, the silence is pretty strong.
What complicates an already complicated situation is that these terrorist acts, as we saw in Paris, give people on the right, and all of us, frankly, I mean, I don't think we should just dismiss it as a right-wing issue. All of us reason to pause and consider what is the cost of exposing ourselves.
But that's got nothing to do with refugees, though.
But they get tainted. That's the problem.
But they shouldn't
Of course, they shouldn't be.
These people were from France and from Belgium.
Absolutely. But people are not seeing a distinction. Those people are, and it allows the right wing in particular to say, look, this is what we're letting in. This is our future. These are cultures that are not absorbing. And I think the governments of France in particular, but Germany also, have to take historic account responsibility for that. But it does get all intertwined, all of this. And of course, it's not reasonable to say that every young 20-year-old Syrian man is a terrorist.
And the context which you allude to, but we haven't specifically mentioned, is of course the subtle growth of far-right parties, which is precisely what gives that right-wing charge added force, added bite, and forces mainstream politicians to tack to the right as well. It's easy for us to say, well, be brave, stand up to it, but of course that could involve effectively losing office and ceding all the ground to those parties.
And look at you're seeing in Denmark and Switzerland, where there are these policies being put forward that say if any refugee comes in with money, we are going to take it and make them pay a certain amount for being cared
for. Because
Denmark
and Switzerland are really sort of really poor and up against it at the moment.
Exactly,
aren't they?
Exactly. They're struggling nations, you know, right down there with yeah, yes. And so, you know, and that is a response, particularly in Denmark, to a right-wing government or a right-wing party pushing an agenda that's anti-immigrant. And yeah, it really is. It's a poisonous problem. But I think that there is no short-term solution. The Prime Minister of Holland said we've got 6 to 8 weeks to solve the Dublin issue. That is where people land. They claim asylum. We don't. This is a 6 to 8 year project, and we better figure out how we're going to make it through those next 6 to 8 years.
Shashank, where do we go from here? Because there has been, as Jeffrey says, a lot of talk about, look, we have to do something very urgently. Schengen won't survive unless we find a solution in the next 2 or 3 months. There's a lot of talk coming out of Berlin that Angela Merkel is going to have to change course within the next few months. Where do you see things changing in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I think it's difficult to tell because it's going to be from the vantage point here in London, because it will be upturned and complicated by Britain's own tangled, you know, terribly timed, you know, intervention into this, which is, of course, the EU referendum and the attempt to renegotiate our relationship with Europe. Britain will be dragged into the process of settlement numbers and quotas, and we'll try and keep ourselves at arm's length. I think without some kind of progress on quotas and resettlements, German policy will be politically unsustainable. But I think the one bright spot on the horizon is possibly Libya, where we have seen movements towards a political solution, a unity government, the two sides, East and West, slightly coming together. This could lay the path down to European military intervention in Libya, directly focused on destroying boats. Now, whatever the merits or demerits of that, I think that's a highly possible scenario within a matter of months at this point.
Well, it's interesting. You're having spent so much time in Libya in 2011 covering the fall of Gaddafi, I find it hard to be optimistic about any positive outcome in Libya. It is such a Balkanized country. It is so much run by its regional mafias, the tribes who are constantly vying for power. But you are right. I think that you're right on. The first Libya is part of solving this problem because Libya is where so many refugees are coming from. If there were a way to stabilize that country of 6 million and actually somehow stop the refugee flow in and off the beaches, that would lessen the flow. Turkey is still there, but Libya could be contained.
Whether, you know, what happens in Libya helps or not, at least that does seem to be talking about the problem and where people are coming from. Where I must say, you know, there is very little discussion about, okay, not the sexiest topic in the world, but democracy in Eritrea. And yet, you know, perhaps up to a quarter of the refugees arriving in the European Union are coming from Eritrea. They're fleeing a dictatorship. But when was the last time you heard a European politician talk about, well, we must do something about Eritrea?
Yeah, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because we have very limited foreign policy bandwidth, and I don't think it's really possible to expect publics here to grasp the intricacies of conflicts in North Africa, in the Middle East, in the Levant, in the Gulf, Saudi-Iran tensions, and Eritrea, which they haven't been told about for years.
But this isn't about the public grasping it. This is about policymakers going, what's going to solve the problem? Well, perhaps if Eritrea wasn't a horrendous dictatorship which people fled from, then things might be better.
But I think, as in the case of Sisi's Egypt, which we may talk about later on, there's a sense of impotence. There's a sense of we have very few policy levers that will make this problem better rather than worse.
Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think that for the last number of years, really since the Arab Spring destabilized that region, there has been a policy of letting it sit at a slow boil and ring fencing, if I can mix my metaphors, this problem and saying, listen, as long as these Syrian factions are going after each other, we there isn't really a good guy or a bad guy anymore. Let's just let it go on. And intervention has not been, as we've seen from Barack Obama, an option. The problem we now face is that with this massive number of refugees, which is where we began, this is no longer a problem that can be ring-fenced.
Well, let's turn our attention now to Syria. Peace talks intended to tackle the conflict are due to begin in Geneva, John Kerry has said, although it's still unclear as to who exactly will be invited. The talks are supposed to kick off on Monday. Meanwhile, earlier this week, it was claimed in the FT that Vladimir Putin sent Russia's Director of Military Intelligence to Damascus late last year to ask Bashar al-Assad to step aside, an offer which Assad apparently refused. Shashank, when you look at the possibility of peace talks taking place in Geneva, are there signs of hope which make you think, okay, this time there might be the right people around the table with the right frame of mind to make some sort of progress?
Well, the story about Russia sending its envoy to Syria makes me slightly more optimistic, but that actually, let's be clear, that was months ago. The official in question died a few days later. Russian officials have a very high death rate. It's an occupational hazard, but also it didn't work. And most importantly, what's happened is the Russian offensive has gone quite well in the last few weeks. And I think that that has lessened Moscow's incentive to deal honestly. I was in Moscow about a month ago. And the problem here, the reason the peace talks are in question is very simple. Everyone agrees, it's who will represent the opposition. Everyone agrees who can come. Free Syrian Army, a couple of innocuous types. Everyone agrees who can't come. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, good. It's that grey area where even the Russians themselves are highly ambiguous. To give you an example, one of the representatives of the opposition, the chief negotiator, in fact, is Mohammad Alush. He's related to Zahran Alush, who was killed in a Russian airstrike a few weeks ago. And he's linked to Jaish al-Islam, which is a Saudi-backed Salafi group, so an ultra-conservative Islamist group. Russia considers them terrorists. Iran considers them terrorists. And as of now, they won't be allowed to sit with the regime. So that grey area has to be resolved. And as long as Putin feels he is doing well, he's winning, in quotation marks, the incentive to soften on that will be quite limited.
Jeffrey, what do you expect is likely to take place next week?
I mean, I think the first thing is we have to see whether it actually happens. I don't think it's by any means a foregone conclusion that these talks will happen. John Kerry is already backtracking on the actual day they'll begin. They were scheduled for Monday. He's saying, well, they might show up Tuesday, might be Wednesday. He clearly can see the signals that are coming out of these disparate groups. So, you know, I think that's number one. Will we, a week from now, have anything new to report beyond, you know, something that's just sort of that's not progressing? This is a really difficult negotiation. I think that the people who are trying to mediate this, John Kerry in particular, I don't know how you reconcile these conflicting groups. And as we've already talked about, when one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, we've heard that term before. In this case, how do you reconcile these perspectives? And given that you know, this is a bit like an extreme of the American political right. You know, I'd rather see you, you know, if I can't win, I want to make sure you lose.
I should be clear, though. I mean, one bright spark has been a surprising degree of reconciliation on the opposition side, right? They all turned up in Riyadh end of last year for a conference, and Jordan was allowed to handle that process. Jordan is seen as perhaps, you know, less meddlesome, less obsessive than Saudi Arabia. It was agreed that it would deal with the terrorist list, who can't come and who can come. And actually, you know, it was a pretty impressive display from these people. The sticking points were not on the opposition side, although there are issues around Kurds. The Arabs don't like the Kurds. They think the Kurds are backing Assad, why should they turn up on the opposition side? Actually, the issue really here, I think, is very simple. It's Russia agreeing that Assad has to go, and I do think they agree he has to go and will have to go eventually. It's really trying to extract the maximum price for that in the form of keeping away the people they don't like. And if they cannot have them there, they'd rather not.
And it's interesting, Jeffrey, that as much as we were just discussing how Europe is being affected by the refugee crisis and the crisis in Syria is one of the main reasons for that, European leaders aren't going to be the key players around the table, are they?
No, this is very much an American-led effort, and Russia, you know, they're the people who you really have to watch. I find it hard to imagine. I think one of the things that I think we have to be careful about when you see a bunch of opposition leaders and representatives around a table is, are they actually able to deliver what they're claiming to represent? And I think that, you know, you often see in these kind of circumstances. And this was actually an issue with Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian question in the Middle East. One of the reasons it was often speculated that he never really could go further was because he knew in his heart that he couldn't actually deliver his people behind him. And I think that's going to be a huge issue for all of these disparate groups.
Just before we head to a break, if we have time for a break, let's turn our attention to Egypt. 5 years ago this month, Egypt had its revolution, if we can call it a revolution. There was a mass uprising that lasted 18 days. The president, Hosni Mubarak, was forced to step down. But Shashank Joshi, you know, when you look at the situation in Egypt now, there's a military strongman in power. The opposition is being crushed. People are being arrested, rounded up. People are being killed. It's not as if you can look at the last 5 years as progress, is it?
No, it's awful. It's regression. It's clear to anyone who has looked at Egypt with any degree of care that it's a more repressive, oppressive place than it was during the last years of Hosni Mubarak. There are 40,000 political detainees in prison. There are second most journalists in prison anywhere in the world other than China. Thousands of Muslim Brotherhood supporters sentenced to death under a kangaroo court with highly political motivations. But the fact is, Egypt is strategically important. It's important to Libya and what we talked about there, stabilizing conflicting sides. It's important to Gaza and therefore the Arab-Israeli conflict. And it's a bigger player in the Middle East as a whole, of course. This is a major power that can even influence developments in Syria. And so the Western powers, the US, but also Germany and the UK and others, have decided this level of escalating autocracy has to be ignored, and ultimately weapon sales have to go ahead, political engagement has to continue, and Egypt can't be forfeited as a strategic prize.
Jeffrey Kaufman, Egypt is the perfect symbol, isn't it, of the way the West views democracy in the Middle East. It's, yes, it would be nice if you were democratic, but we don't really mind so long as you're basically on our side.
Well, yeah. I mean, so what exactly would you do if you were the president of the United States? I mean, of course, you're right on one level, but you know, as we've already seen in the abject failure of the experiments to seed democracy in Iraq and Afghanistan, just exactly how do you do that successfully?
I would not sell Apache attack helicopters to Sisi for a start.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you're right, and Canada selling tanks to the Saudis, frankly, you know,
this isn't an issue of, you know, the West going into Egypt and imposing democracy. If anything, it's the other way around. It's the West going into Egypt helping the undemocratic elements in Egypt stay in power.
But I think their fear is that if they cancel military contracts, they are going to lose the tenuous hold they have on the relations they have with Egypt, and they need Egypt, and it is the deal with the devil. But they are prepared to live with it.
I mean, the other problem, of course, is that there are other forces waiting in the sidelines, and that's Russia. Russia is moving, you know, inexorably closer to Egypt. They've sold arms. Sisi is very fond of Putin, I think, you know, on a personal level, both strong, you know, strong men saving their country from chaos. And that's got to be a concern, mm-hmm. you know, with Russia deepening its hold on Syria at the strategic level. Is it better or worse for freedom, in a sense, that Russian influence is kept limited?
You know, it sounds an awful lot like the Cold War.
Well, of course, on a thankfully more minor scale, there are not thousands of Russian advisors in country all across the region. They're just in one country, which is some progress, I suppose.
Well, look, on that issue, that question that you raise, is it actually better for freedom that Egypt isn't as close to Russia and has a working relationship? Egypt's leaders have a working relationship with Western leaders. Are you comfortable? Not necessarily comfortable with that realpolitik, but do you think that actually that is perhaps the best solution right now?
I think that what it does buy us is limited leverage in situations where we want one particular side to win or do better than the other side. And I'm thinking here, for example, of Gaza, where I'd rather see Hamas weak in negotiations than strong, all things considered, although I recognize they will be an important interlocutor in talks. And in that sense, I think being able to influence Egypt is important, and it does favor objectives that are, broadly speaking, worthwhile to me.
But it is chilling, nonetheless, and I think we all agree. When you look at the harsh measures being taken, the death sentences being handed out, the arrest of people because they have Facebook accounts, the huge violation of human rights going on without any sense of accountability, fairness, transparency. This Arab Spring, this is the Arab frost now, and it's really, really frightening to see close.
One last thing on this. We shouldn't blame just the Americans, of course. It's worth remembering that Sisi traveled to Berlin. He was met by Angela Merkel, you know, the savior of Europe and she who can do no wrong. He came to the UK. The red carpet was rolled out. I think it's easy to think of this as somehow the US clicks its fingers and it all changes. But of course, this requires some degree of unity amongst major powers as well. If you want to isolate a country, you have to do it together. You can't do it just by yourself.
You can't isolate Egypt. It's too big. 90 million people in it. It's the biggest country in the region. It's just too powerful. And I do agree that letting it fall into the hands of Putin really does. It has consequences on so many other issues in the region.
Okay, so there we are. The world is a bit of a mess, but fear not, because America is going to elect a new president, and Donald J. Trump may be the man to come to the rescue. At least it seems that now there is a bit more opposition to Donald Trump's candidacy amongst conservatives in the US, Shashank. And we've seen that the National Review, America's oldest conservative publication, has, I think it's fair to say, pretty much gone to war with Trump. It published a special issue today with a headline, Against Trump. It features essays from 22 prominent conservative writers, all of whom argue that Trump is a threat, not just to the political left or centre-left, but also to the political right. But Shank, does this actually matter in American politics right now? Isn't this just going to be seen by lots of Republican voters as, well, this is just the establishment looking after their own?
Yeah, I mean, and what's interesting is to look at the criticisms the National Review levelled at him, right? That's very telling. He said he was philosophically unmoored. I don't think Trump supporters care whether they're philosophically moored. In fact, they probably see this untethering as a kind of intellectual liberation and advancement. They said he was, popular. They talked about popular. Again, I don't think that's a dirty word for Trump supporters. But the irony to me is when I look at some of the people who've written these critiques and my eyes are popping out. I mean, Glenn Beck, he is writing for the National Review. I remember
even Glenn Beck thinks Trump is too mad.
Well, I had assumed he'd gone off the deep end years ago. And then I see that he's actually drifted into the sort of acceptable mainstream of this rightist critique of Trump?
This is nothing less than a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. And it may, in fact, be an existential battle for the party. If it doesn't find a way to navigate this, it could ultimately split it in two. And what you need to add to it's very interesting that this anti-Trump coalition of people like Glenn Beck, who, what I would say as a reporter who was based in the U.S., worked for an American network for a very long time, Glenn Beck, in my mind, is one of the most right-wing commentators. I mean, far, far fringe, means frothing, spewing right-wing
conspiracy
commentators.
Theory.
Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, right out there. For him to say Donald Trump is a menace. But you have to look at the other side. Who's the other leading contender? Ted Cruz. And, the governor of Iowa saying, don't vote for Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is himself equally divisive and just loathed by people within his own party.
But here's the problem, Shank, and to tie up lots of what we talked about a little bit earlier, it's all very well people in the so-called moderate centre-ish, and I'm obviously that's a bit of a broad brush stroke, saying these guys are crazy, don't vote for them. but there is not enough of a positive message that those candidates are putting forward for themselves, is there?
And I'd go even further. I'd say that elements of Trump are the distillation or the sort of embellishment of ideas within that mainstream. So whilst people like Nikki Haley have courageously pushed back at some of the anti-immigration rhetoric, stuff that Marco Rubio or even Jeb Bush and others have said, very mainstream candidates, actually it's not necessarily that far off. And in terms of the xenophobia, in terms of the ultra hawkishness, that's an echo of the mainstream debate.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, even though Jeffrey wanted to jump in. We didn't even have time to talk about Litvinenko or indeed have a break, but there we are. Thank you very much. That was Midori House. Special thanks to our guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and Shashank Joshi. The producer was Daniel Giacopelli. The researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federico Romaniello. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Ribello is here next. Then it's Marcus Hippie with the menu at 1900. Midori House back same time on Monday. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.